I'm Jesse Driscoll. I'm here with Christian Davenport, and we're bringing you the Raiders of the Lost Archive. Archives are repositories of special information. Archives can take many forms, historical documents, oral histories, or data sets that can't just be downloaded. We're asking questions to allow some special guests to speak candidly about their research process. The conversations will be archived here for the social science community. Thanks for listening, and enjoy. David, the way we normally start this is we let people introduce themselves the way they'd like to be introduced. So how would you introduce yourself?
My name is David Layton, and I'm a professor of political science at Stanford University.
You've done more field work in more diverse places than most senior scholars, I think it's fair to say. When you think about the five locations that you've sketched out, Somalia, Nigeria, Catalonia, Estonia, and France, which of them would you like to talk about first?
Whatever you would prefer, but the one way I was thinking about it was to go through your questions, and if there's an interesting answer for one of the places, I would focus on that place. But I'm willing to start with any country you find interesting enough for me to.
All of your answers are interesting to me, but I'm pretty biased. How about we start with Estonia? Because of what's going on in the news right now with Ukraine, it's at the top of my mind. So what was the topic or question you were interested in examining for the research project that you were going into the field to collect data on for Eastern Europe?
When I was beginning to write up my research on the language revival movement in Catalonia, in late 1980s, the Union Republics of the now former Soviet Union were all writing new language laws, undermining the Russian speakers' historic right to remain monolingual. And they were requiring the Union Republic governments and the Supreme Soviets were requiring education and administration in the Union Republic language, which would affect the 25 million Russian speakers who lived outside the Russian Federation. I felt that the 14 cases in the Soviet Union were historic and crucially important, and dropped my research on Catalonia, started studying Russian, and wanted to know what the political strategies of the Russian speakers would be in the face of national movements by the Union Republic majorities. I chose Estonia because it had great similarity to the situation in Catalonia, where 65% of the population, more or less, was culturally rooted in the region, with 30-35% of the population being migrants of the past few generations from the political center, Madrid in Catalonia and Russia in Estonia. So it would give me a comparison point, and I started off with a hypothesis that Estonians might succeed in turning Russians into Estonians through assimilation processes similar to Catalonia. And I wanted to test if this was true in Estonia and if you would have different outcomes for Union republics with different titular nationalities.
So you just learned Russian, huh?
Well, it wasn't so easy. I started studying Russian 101 at University of Chicago, and the students there were mostly taking it to fulfill requirements and were more concerned about their grades than they were about speaking Russian. So I did two things. One, I hired a tutor who came in regularly to my office for an hour and a half, maybe two or three times a week. And I also made a few trips to Estonia, asking host to to make appointments every day for me with retired people who had nothing to do but to talk to some American. So I spent hours talking to bored Russians and who spoke no English, and I developed minimal competence to be able to conduct the research.
That is great, David. Let me jump to Somalia for a second, but it's more to the topic in many respects. I'm like, what was it about language? What brought you to language as a topic? I mean, because there's many things that persisted between the kind of the colony and then the post-colonial situation, but there's an interest that you had in language that seems to kind of be more or less consistent throughout your career. And I'm just kind of curious what led you to that. And David, today I just realized, I had not realized today, we share a birthday.
No kidding.
You're 20 years older, but we also share a birthday. I was like, get out of here. Not that I believe in any of that, but that just explains a bunch for me. So I always knew I liked you, but now you're over the top. But to the question, sorry.
You share my twin sister's birthday as well. That's magnificent.
Oh, wow. So,
Christian, that's a great question because some people say I'm tremendously broad in my interests and my research goes everywhere. But actually, my research is quite narrow, asking very similar questions across the five field sites that in which I conducted field research. So I'll tell you a story that helps answer your question. When I came to Berkeley in 1967, the study of Africa, and the reason why I was interested in Africa, where I had never been, was 1960, and when I was 15 years old, was the moment of African independence. It was the most exciting political event of my teenagehood. And John Kennedy, my idol, gave this great speech as a senator on supporting the FLN in Algeria. And I saw this as the future, and I wanted to understand it. So I got to Berkeley, and the major concern of Africanists at that time was whether the countries were going to become mobilization systems or reconciliation systems. Would they ally with the Soviets or would they ally with the Americans? And I read this material and had some interest in it, but I said, you'll never understand politics in Africa because most people in Africa, even though I had no idea about this or no empirical support for this, but most people in Africa couldn't care less if they were pro-Soviet or pro-American. They had other concerns that came with independence. And I was much influenced by the poetry of Aimé César and Léopold Senghor in this great notion of negritude coming out in poetry and the return to African culture. And African culture could be revived with independence. And I said to myself, we're now 7 or 8 years into independence, and the key aspect of African culture might be language. And the official languages of every single African state was either French or English. Where is African culture here? And even Léopold Senghor was a committed Francophone as president of Senegal. Why are we not getting a cultural renaissance in language? This is something that most people anywhere in an African country would care about, because the kids were going to school learning languages that they themselves didn't speak. This had to be political. Why wasn't there a cultural renaissance with language? And people like Ali Mizrui, when I spoke to him, he was the dean of Africanists, said, David, this is ridiculous. They can't have indigenous languages because there are so many, 400 languages in Nigeria. Which one are they going to choose? They choose the one that's equally non-understood by all cultural groups or all tribes, English, which is a sign of equality. And I had one factoid in my head. about Somalia. It was a country that 100% of the people spoke Somali, but they had three official languages, Arabic, English, and Italian. So if you were trying to be equal or fair, why is Somalia still operating in three foreign languages? This is something that needs to be understood better. And the consequences of continuing in colonial languages for political culture had to be important. And that was an initial insight. And the more I studied it, the more interested I got into issues of cultural revival and linguistic disappearance and multilingualism and a whole range of issues that pervades almost all my research.
Can I ask a follow-up question to that? You have said that one of the worst pieces of advice that you can get on the job market is to try to game the job market, to try to condition your research as a graduate student on the kind of research that you think is going to get you a job. And I've heard you say that many times. Yet you did get a job. So my question is about process. I mean, what did you do? Did you convince your advisors over the course of your dissertation that your question was a good one, and then they helped you overcome the field's confusion about what the field should care about? Or did you just kind of get lucky? Or did you sell it in a job talk? Or how did you get your hands on the ladder, having done something that was so far afield from what most Africanists thought Africa should be in the minds of the academy?
First, I should say that I was on the job market for 15, 18 months before getting an interview. And second, I never, ever got an interview for a job for an Africanist. The first job offer I got was at University of Chicago. And that was pushed by one of my two advisors, Ernst Haas, who was an IR specialist. And intellectually, he had never studied anything about language and knew nothing about Africa. But he thought I was an unusual intellectual. And he convinced the folk at University of Chicago, which was not so interested in professional and much more interested in intellectual issues, he convinced them to look at me. And I got there, and intellectually, what the Jews call pilpul, back and forth argumentation, they were very excited about me as a scholar rather than as an Africanist. I also got interviewed at UC San Diego, and they were just beginning a department. And Ernst Haas, again, used his contacts with Martin Shapiro, who was co-chair of the department at the time, that I had the breadth of interest that would be very useful for a department that had 17 FTEs and was going to be in a mode of departmental building. So my first two job offers came from support of my dissertation advisor and had nothing to do with the fact that I wrote about Somalia.
Thanks for that. I don't think most people knew that about you. I certainly didn't. So when you did your second, just since we're sort of bopping around here a little bit, when you did your second work, your second kind of field work in Nigeria, your second round post-tenure, you took your family with you. What do you remember about the challenges involved in that? I have young kids now, and I would never consider taking them to the field with me. I would think it would be too much work.
The challenges were immense, bringing a family to Ile-Ife. One important thing was that I wasn't going to be able to live, as it were, in the middle of an African town in a typical compound. That would be, I thought, too risky. And therefore, I somehow made contacts with the political scientists at University of Ife. Now it's called Owolowo University in Ile Ife, southwestern Nigeria, in Yoruba land. I made contacts with them. They had no idea who I was. And I said that I would be willing to teach courses for them for free if they gave me a house on the campus. And the campus was like an aristocratic British estate of the 19th century with beautiful houses. And they had a staff school there, which would be operating in English because kids from all over Nigeria were children of the faculty. And there was a faculty club with a swimming pool and all this. And it was about a 5-minute drive to the center of the city. So I was actually commuting to my interviews and to my other fieldwork activities while my family was living in a relatively safe environment. And my wife, who wanted to move from city planning to architecture, there was a new exciting architecture program there. And I got her contacts to sort of matriculate there. That almost worked out well. But finding a place for her, finding a place for the kids involved a great deal of planning. And this was before email, before any kind of electronic communication. It all had to be done through, for example, visiting the Ife campus with a name of a professor, finding out where his house was. Nobody was at the house. Sitting there for 5 hours waiting for the family to come home from wherever they were and introducing myself. And all they could do was give me a big, big lunch. And after a talk for 20 minutes or 30 minutes, I proposed that maybe I could teach a course there if I could get housing. And he, for some reason, who knows why, they needed someone to teach an extra course in comparative politics, worked to help me get this position.
Okay, David, as a non-proponent of astrology, your consistent rebelliousness and your degree of hustle, also coming from Brooklyn and also now the Gemini thing, I'm like, okay, I'm seeing all types of connections that I did not see before. So, David, you outlined something that is really fascinating in many respects. You have, to the question, what did people tell you when you were going into the field? You show a repeated disdain for lack of concern what anyone thought. And at the same time, these people who are offering advice, like Haas, you get them to engender a certain degree of faith and understanding in you, and thus they become invested. This sounds it's a delicate balance. On the one hand, you're just like, you have people telling you you'll never get a job. Why are you doing this? Okay, interesting idea, but you're doing it in a way that's revealing your utter ignorance. And basically, you're ignoring them and you're going about doing it. And at the same time, you've got them invested in you that help you out professionally. And I'm like, what advice do you have for maintaining that balance, right? Because it seems like consistently you're just kind of like, I'm like, you're not getting me much assistance in going to the field, but I'm going to go anyway, and I'm going to do this. First off, is that accurate? And second, how do you maintain this balance between not disregarding, but moving beyond where your comments and suggestions and advice are going, but still getting people to be invested in you as a scholar and intellectual?
That's a hard one to answer, but I'll give one small piece of maybe insight on this. Is from the very beginning in all projects, I linked my off the chart interests to standard political science questions. Let's say to nation building, to the creation of national cultures, to the coherence of states and the undermining of states, and always would have a political science hook to what I was doing, so political scientists could recognize what I was doing. Even in the Somalia case, I was asking a question of what is political culture and how might it be studied in a systematic way? And even though the word field experiment had not entered the political science vocabulary, people saw the field experiments that I was conducting as speaking to an issue of would political culture of an African country be different if it were relying administratively and educationally in an indigenous language rather than a colonial one. So I always linked what I was doing to things that political scientists could easily recognize.
As a follow-up to that, you also often changed what it was that you thought you knew about the field as a result of the observations that you made in the field. And that's something that is consistent across all of the research projects that you did. And now one of the things that the field expects of you is pre-registration or pre-analysis plans, where you not only have a sense of the hypotheses that you're going to use, you know, to analyze data for transparency, but even the code that you're going to run on the data that you're going to find before you go looking. You know, otherwise you will be accused of, I believe the term is phishing for results. How would you advise students to navigate around that constraint while also keeping their advisors happy in the current environment?
I published a paper which I called Fisheries Management, in which I addressed this issue, which is a crucial one for young scholars in comparative politics. On the one hand, I think being much more attentive to your hypotheses and your expectations with a pre-analysis plan is an excellent innovation in our discipline for reining us in to test conjectures and hypotheses or theories. On the other hand, I am insistent that going to the field, young scholars need to keep their eyes open. To see whether the pre-analysis plan actually speaks to the issues that they think is most important, that are testing the theories they thought they were testing, that it was appropriate for the place they're in, or if there's something much more exciting for the discipline to be attentive to than what they went in with. And this kind of flexibility, let us call it phishing, has tremendous benefits. And then you call what you've done exploratory rather than confirmatory. And I'm pushing the discipline as best I can to understand the role exploratory analysis at the dissertation level beats boring, useless experimental work that was wrongly conceived in going into the field.
David, is it fair to suggest that your the way things are set up now, you kind of have folks that are kind of going out and doing ethnographic work and the detailed version of it, and then you have some folks that do some experiments, and then you have some folks that both in the field and in a lab or something. And you have some people that are kind of like running analyses. I think I gather from you, and this is from kind of like personal interactions at LICEP, but just also kind of listening to you generally, I've always viewed you as someone who doesn't really accept that separation and really has this oscillating or more dynamic and coevolutionary kind of approach where things are moving towards truth, but you're using all these different tools. Is that a fair characterization of kind of, because I think of this in line of your answer to where you've gone to collect research material, because we're very much interested in kind of like archives, but archives broadly conceived, and from moving from mosques to classes to just regular folks in a field to kind of like working in working on a computer. I mean, you've moved across archives. So would you think my characterization of your approach, such as it is reasonable, or how would you state it?
It is reasonable, but it may be defunct. I think the field is getting so technically sophisticated with different techniques for running experiments, for doing the econometric analysis of the experiments, of soaking and poking in the field, that it's increasingly difficult for someone to be an amateur in all these different techniques. Jesse has often said that he would love to do more theory in his work, but any game theory that he could write would be laughed at by economic theorists, and so better not do that. I think now we're moving much more to a world of collaboration, in which collaborative groups share the tasks of putting together a research project. And this has vastly changed the mode of operation in comparative politics. And the idea of one person being able to put it all together, the theory, the econometrics, the field work, the language, the archives, and whatever, is increasingly difficult. And so we're living in a world of collaboration rather than the single scholar doing all aspects of the research program. And what that means organizationally is something which is still being worked out. In economics today, a dissertation often involves three papers, with the student being not having a single authored paper in any of the three. And political science is coming more and more in that direction, so that collaboration rather than individual breadth seems to be the answer to the technological revolution that we're living in.
It seems like you were an innovator or an early mover in that space too. I mean, to move us back to Estonia, you ended up with your name on a book that I have on my shelf, but you actually managed a large team of different people in different sites, all doing ethnography. And, you helped start those careers. And there's also a lot of other kinds of data and other kinds of archives that you used to make the cross-national case, because standpoint epistemology is real, and it's not really an Estonia book. It's really a book about the breakup of the Soviet Union. I guess I have a question about what's being lost in that new lab science mode, aesthetically. So if you think about how graduate student training is different, not a normative judgment, but compared to what it was 20 years ago, 40 years ago, however far back you want to go, what is it that you think used to be a standard part of the training program that is gone now?
So I think I got zero training in Berkeley, and I was only a student there for 3 years, and never took a statistics course, never took an econometrics course, and never took a course in running experiments or fieldwork course. I just took courses where we read books and articles and discussed them. Now our students, a typical student wants a seventh year of graduate school to develop techniques. In a sense, students are going out in the field with much more technical expertise, much better advice on how to do field work, on how to run experiments. And more and more students are fluent in the language that of the place they're going before they even start graduate school. So they
because
have to,
because they're from there.
They're from there, or they studied it very, very much before they started graduate school. We have a number of Arabic speakers who are not native Arabic speakers who are fluent in our graduate program.
Fair enough.
So it's in a sense a lot is being retained. And when I think of your work, Jesse, when I think of Michael Albertus's work, when I think of Claire Adida's work, when I think of Amanda Robinson's work and many others, they were able to do all aspects of the work and make a major contribution by themselves, and to do so with maybe twice as much real training. Well, it couldn't be twice as much because I got zero real training, but a lot more training than I got. So maybe it's more hopeful than I was suggesting in my last answer.
Related to that, David, I was really drawn to wonder what it was about the Sardana that changed your course of career from Gramsci to Schelling. But I want to relate that to the answer you just gave. Because it sounds as if you were open to seeing a performance and you actually went to a performance and then were changed by something that then kind of shifted your whole intellectual orientation. That does not sound like the youth of today that would be open to an experience like that, let alone change from it. So I'm just curious, what was that specific, describe the Sardana first off and then kind of give us what that shift was. And what is it about, is it you as a personality that was open to being shifted at this point? Or is it something that was just so profound that you could not ignore it? Do you see that there's anything within how people are being socialized and educated now that would similarly open them up? Because I'm not seeing that. So I actually view the current context as very antithetical to such kind of like prophetic, very kind of substantive moments, especially coming from culture. But help me, disabuse me of this pessimism.
So when I wrote my book on Yorubaland and Nigeria, hegemony and culture, I had this belief that there were ideological blocks. Today I would call them ideological equilibria that sustained people into deep beliefs about how the world worked, and they conditioned their behavior on those beliefs. And this came basically from Gramsci and trying to understand why capitalism survived under conditions where there was a sufficient size of an oppressed working class that was buying into what he called the hegemonic bloc of capitalist society. So I had this idea that what drove me the Catalan case was how the hegemonic bloc supporting all Spanish-speaking Spain was able to thrive, and what it would take as a counter-hegemony to upset this. And it was an ideological war of counter-hegemony that the Catalans were engaged in. And Juan Linz, who was the leading scholar of Spain at the time, thought what I was saying was interesting and extremely skeptical of any of this. He just wanted me to do surveys, and which he did in an exemplary way, and on which I relied. So I'm walking through the neighborhood of where we had settled in Barcelona, where I could study this. Sardana is sort of the national dance of the Catalans, and it's not done in the theater. It's done in front of cathedrals and churches late in the afternoon. I knew about the Sardana because, in one sense, Picasso has a beautiful piece called the Sardana of Peace, which shows totally happy peasants dancing in circles and profiting from the beauties of Catalan culture. And this, so when I heard the music in front of the cathedral in the village of Sarrià within Barcelona, I was so excited. And I started watching, and people coming back from work or people coming back from Corte Inglés and with their packages and their briefcases and their coats, would all put their, as it were, their briefcases in the center of a circle, and they would dance around it. So this was the perfect urban dance. They were able to be free of all the stuff that they were carrying. No one could get into the circle to steal it. And the dance was the most boring dance I've ever seen. Some 150 steps in one direction and 150 steps the other direction, back and forth and back and forth, with nothing happening. And I said, these Catalans, I said to myself, have developed the perfect dance for the bourgeoisie. They can dance in the middle of a cosmopolitan city and spend the whole time watching their money. And I said, hegemony is not the way to think about this. Why is it? Why is it that they're able to coordinate on a political program that would enable them to increase their communicative capabilities by zero and spend a whole lot of effort doing so? And I couldn't answer that question. And I walked around town for a couple of days and said, I remember reading something by Schelling about coordination when I was an undergraduate, because Berkeley didn't teach me anything. But as an undergraduate, I read Schelling and I said, there's something about a coordination game going on here. And this may be more Schelling than Gramsci. So I wrote Bob Bates a letter, because Bob Bates was known to me, although I wasn't a good friend of his, as someone that was involved in some game theory. And I wrote him a letter describing what I thought was going on. And he wrote back to me and said, great to hear from you, David, but you're really great on culture and not very good on game theory. Why don't you stick with culture? I got some support in an odd way. I'll tell that story if you want, for my idea. And it began a whole new approach to understanding culture through an understanding of the challenges of coordination that game theorists had made a great deal of theoretical progress on, and I tried to adapt to the language revival world.
I would much rather hear your answer about support in an odd way than the second part of Christian's rambly question about the kids these days. So what was the odd kind of support that you got?
So so I connected with, when I was in Barcelona, I connected with a sociologist who was well known for her work on the children of immigrants, that is, the children of migrants from Andalusia and Extremadura into Catalonia, and studied their language abilities, their behavior, and the degree to which they're becoming Catalans. And so I visited her office, and we became collaborators. We have a couple of papers jointly written, and I still remain very close to her intellectually. After this experience in Sarria and the Sardona, I came to her and started talking about coordination games. And she looked at me and said, "David, I have no idea what you're talking about, but there was a guy in my communist cell in the Franco years who talked just like that. And he comes back to Barcelona every once in a while. I'll introduce you." And I said, "Great." And this person turned out to be one of the great macroeconomists of our time, Andreu Mascolel, who was a Catalan nationalist, who was then a mathematical economist at both Berkeley and Harvard. And she introduced me to him, and I tried to tell him what I was thinking about. And he said, "David, I've been a game theorist and a Catalan nationalist my whole adult life, but I never thought of putting them together. You know nothing about game theory, but that's easy. Having connected them is a real great achievement. I'll help you."
As a follow-up to that, I want to ask you about the failure of coordination by the Russian-speaking population. You call them the beach diaspora, all across Eastern Europe, where, you know, these are now the children of the people that you studied. But they have a very difficult time successfully advocating for their rights, cultural rights, qua Russians, not just Estonia, but elsewhere. And, you know, it's easy to ex post identify a coordination equilibrium. It's also pretty easy ex post to identify a market failure or a coordination failure, at least to assert that you've identified one. Without context, it's hard to know whether you're right or wrong. But I would be interested to know how you think about the, I think what you would call a coordination failure by Russian speakers living outside of Russia.
So when I worked through my initial conjectures about the Russian-speaking populations of the former Soviet Union, I was thinking more of the conditions under which you would get coordination failure, say in Estonia, which I called competitive assimilation, where each Russian-speaking family would see the advantages if their kid were the first ones to speak Estonian for social mobility within this new republic, or the conditions under which the coordination failure would be that Russians felt there would be no future for them because they weren't sufficiently geographically concentrated, and they would, in the long term, not be welcome in the country, as was, and therefore the you would not get assimilation, you would more likely get exit, and I saw that as the likely outcome in Kazakhstan. Where I found likelihood of coordination success was in Eastern Ukraine. And I argued that there would be likely to be coordination success, which turned out to be something like the party of the regions, which had electoral success. And my prediction was the outcome would look much more like Belgium, with the consolidated Russian-speaking east and south, and consolidated Ukrainian-speaking west. And there was a case because of geographical concentration and relative high status of the Russian language compared to Ukrainian language, that there would be incentive for coordination. And events occurred in more or less in the direction I believe I predicted, but But events, of course, in the past couple of years have made the Belgian solution look obsolete.
Fair enough.
So, yeah, Jesse, the question I was going to ask, I want to deviate from that for a second. David, so we're in this space where there's been a lot of attention to kind of like social media as a potential archive that's worthwhile for kind of exploiting. And obviously you're aware of this, but I'm curious, what do you think is the one space for information and insight that we're not tapping, or we're not tapping well enough to add to this kind of like repertoire of different archives that we could draw from, because you've drawn from so many over the course of your work and might have some insights as to this? I'm sure you do.
I'm not sure I do. I'm working some now with Twitter data, and that's an amazing archive. I would think, however, that the questions today, if you think about, say, the early Axelrod models of ABMs, agent-based models, that folk were constrained completely by interactions in their Moore neighborhood, that is, a geographical proximity. I think, though, the world we're now living in, that geographical proximity is much less consequential for organization than it had been, and we're getting degrees of coordination that are delinked from geography. And what that means for all sorts of political behavior is something I don't fully understand, and I think it's worthwhile trying to think through, first with ABMs and then with real world tests of these models to make predictions about kinds of political organizations that are geographically delinked.
Final question, David. As one of your students, I wonder how long you plan to continue being an active researcher, because you've surprised me, and I think surprised a lot of people, by continuing to extend the productive phase of your career. And I'm wondering, for our listeners, how long you aspire to continue to keep your foot on the gas.
That's not the way I think about it, Jesse, but the way I think about it is, I need some way of getting truthful feedback that the returns to my continued work have become negative, because most of us live in our own balloons, thinking that we're making progress, intellectual progress, but really are. Moving on to brain death. So I haven't been able to get someone who would certainly no graduate student would come to me and say, David, I think you're brain dead. Maybe you ought to stop. And it's hard to get my closest friends, most of whom are in their 40s and 50s, to do that as well. So I'm trying to figure out a way that I get external advice that I'm no longer performing. But I find what I'm doing tremendously exciting, and compared to the alternatives, playing golf or whatever, what I'm doing is much more exciting to me. I just hope that it's giving some value to the discipline and to my colleagues.
Hello, thank you for listening to Raiders of the Lost Archive and for writings mentioned in this podcast, as well as what we're going to be doing in the future. Please feel free to look at archiveraiders.weebly.com.